Okay, we are here with Dr. Howard Howdy Grows Clothes, Ren Spear and I. This is Norman Mock. It's December 30th, 1991. And the first thing on my agenda was to get the spelling of your name straight, because I've seen it six different ways, and I'm guessing that what I saw in the mailbox is the right way to spell it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's G-R-O-S.
One S.
K-L-O-S-S.
Okay.
And even Dick had it when he wrote to me. He had it like Santa Claus.
It's wrong in that article that I gave you, too.
That well, it's wrong in the record books, and it's wrong all over. We just wanted to make sure that we knew that you would know how to spell your name. And
not too old yet.
And one of the things we'll do is correct it in the baseball encyclopedia, because at least this edition has it with two S's in both places. The birth date of April 9th, 1907, is that correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In Pittsburgh?
Right.
Yeah. I have just some very brief comments in addition to your playing record that Dick gave me, that you went to Amherst?
Mm-hmm. Amherst College.
Okay, growing up in Pittsburgh, were you a baseball fan from an early age?
Yes. My father, I was saying, my father died when I was only 8.5 years old. But from the time I was 6, he used to take me out to see Horace Wagner play.
I was Forbes Field, it was built then.
Right.
Yeah. What do you remember of that early ballpark?
Well, I remember that, of course, it is a fine ballpark, still a fine ballpark when they left it for the, what, Three Rivers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And well, except for the fact that, in addition to the fact that it was a very finely organized organization, including the ballpark. It was well kept, beautiful park. And with Shenley Park in the background, and much finer looking park than the present park, which I've only seen once.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I can't think of anything really unusual about it.
You were, your father died when you were 8?
8.5.
8.5, yeah. And did you continue going to games?
Well, no, because after he died, a matter of transportation for one thing, and another thing, no one else in the family was interested in baseball but my father. And he was a friend of Horace Wagner, and his best friend was Al Wagner, who was Horace's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, when I was in I think I was 16 or 17 years of age, Horace Wagner was then out and had his own Santa Pro team. And he found out where I was and took me with him to play against the Zanesville, Ohio Grays. Zanesville Grays.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I remember about that was that Jim Thorpe was playing in the outfield for them.
Oh.
They put me in right field, and I was frightened to death, of course. And that was an experience with Horace Wagner, and I never saw him after that.
What do you remember about him as a person?
Well, first of all, he was very frugal, and secondly, he was extremely conscious of his semi-pro possibilities and made it known. I don't know whether you wish me to go into something that happened as far as medicine is concerned, because I was interested in medicine from the day my father died. I was just saying that I watched him die over a three-day period. And so one of the fellows got stomach ache, and I heard Horace Wagner say, "Oh, Epsom salts, we'll give him some Epsom salts." I said, "I'm sorry, sir," because I had to say sir. He was quite a man. There's a chance that it might be an appendicitis, and I don't think you should do that. That rather disturbed him, because he wanted to give him that. So we prevailed upon him to going back to go back to Pittsburgh and have a consultation, and it wasn't been decided. That's one of my first medical experiences with Thomas Wagner. I thought that might be of interest.
Yeah.
My father, we had a routine. He was had 1 year of law school, and insisted on, even on his dying days, that I would either play professional ball or study law. So he took me to the courthouse, and then we'd go out to the forest field. So that was our routine before he died.
You were, that's interesting that at that early age, he was encouraging you to be a professional ball player.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Had you shown any signs that you had the capacity?
Well, I was so young, but I was the most active athletic kid in the town. Mm. And I think maybe that made an impression on him.
You were not in the city of Pittsburgh?
Suburb, Sheridan.
Uh-huh. What do you remember about Wagner seeing him play when you were that young?
Well, I remember his shortstop activities. I mean, the wide range and the ease with which he would play the ground balls in particular. And his all-around abilities, and, you know, throwing abilities, and his ability, even in that age, I remember him, he had a wide expanse of recovery, you know, of all hits.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember his nonchalance as a ball player. Nothing seemed to bother him. In my age, I can remember things of that nature.
Yeah.
And it's amazing at the age of 8 and a half that I could remember. Maybe it's because of his association with my father, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm. He covered the ground, but apparently did it with the flash of an Ozzie Smith,
Just like a routine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Amazing I would remember that.
When he was in the semi-pro, with the semi-pro team, was he big belly then? Was he heavy?
Began heavy, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And bow-legged?
Bow-legged, right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was too. I followed him that way also.
Did he teach you anything?
No, because I had no direct contact with him at that age.
Even with the semi-pro team?
He told me now, take it easy now. If any ball comes your way, do your best. And I had the last put out of the game. And I remember one of our pitcher, I don't remember his name, came out to take the ball, and Hannes was witnessing that. Hey, that ball belongs to the kid. He made the last put out, so he took the ball away from the pitcher and gave it to me. Now that sticks in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did he teach you anything about hitting?
No, he didn't. The only teaching I had by hitting was by Roger Hornsby when he was managing the Cubs, which was rather unusual. But he worked with me when we played the Cubs, either place. And then they switched me from shortstop to second base. And he taught me in making double plays how to avoid people. Of course, today they're much rougher than they were then, even. And in hitting, I took up his style of hitting. And he was, here, a ball player today, there's a lot of wide stance.
Mm-hmm.
And Hornsby was this way, so he could step this way or that way, and he could hit all fields. So he worked with me on hitting, too.
How did that come about? Did you ask him?
No, he offered. Quite a person. I respected Roger Hornsby about as well as I respect anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He was a fine gentleman. And it was his idea. He knew that I was a rookie,
mm-hmm.
and could use the experience and never played second base before.
Yeah.
So they put Tommy Thevenot in a shortstop, and one of the finest, I think, shortstops of the age. He was sure-handed, on second play, double plays, I knew where that ball was coming every time. I would write the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we set a record for double play at that time of the year. We were,
yeah.
And so if I made a poor throw, he could recover. But when I was receiving it, I knew it was right there every time.
Mm-hmm.
Marvelous. No hitter, but marvelous shortstop.
What did Hornsby teach you about avoiding a sliding runner?
To go past the bag and keep ahead of, you know, above the slide.
Did he teach you all the phantom tag, the being past the, just past the bag when you get the ball?
Well, yes, he said it didn't make much difference. They wouldn't, you know, wouldn't call it that closely.
Yeah. If you missed it by
even
a little
today, enough. They call it less closely, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a, if you're in the vicinity of second base, that's all that's necessary nowadays. Very obvious on television, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
Did your mother remarry?
No, she never did.
Uh-huh. So, when you were playing ball in high school?
Yes. Then I played ball at the Kiske Prep School, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then you decided to, somewhere along the line, to go to medical school instead of law school.
Yes, that takes a little history. I hadn't planned on playing professional baseball at all, number one. Number two, we had a very good team in Amherst. In fact, we were all New England, a small college team, and interestingly enough, Red Wolf was playing in Dartmouth that time, and then he went to the Yankees to play third base, and he and I were back and forth on the battle national battle title for hitting. We were hitting 274, 278, and that sort of thing, you know, and we're good friends too, but through that we became friends.
Mm-hmm.
We went to New York, and at the time I went to Pittsburgh. Then I got several, if you want me to tell you this, and getting into baseball. Mm-hmm. I got several offers then. Well, number one, I should go into it. You want me to go into some detail or not?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
When I was at Kiske, Barney Dreyfus and got interested in me and wanted to sign me up right away. It was just, when I was 16 years old, I got a notice of interview with the Cleveland Browns, Cleveland Browns,
Indians,
Cleveland Indians. And so I passed that up because I wanted to finish school. And then my senior year, I had to get interested. So our coach was somewhat knowledgeable about bonuses and so forth and salaries. So I had three offers, Philadelphia Athletics and Cleveland and Pittsburgh Pirates.
Were these offers made by scouts personally approaching you?
Scouts approaching my coach. Because I didn't want to use my amateur standing. It started before I graduated from Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
And so he more or less became my agent at that time. And so we went down to Boston Braves, which was Boston Braves. And they wouldn't give me a cent. They didn't want to start that sort of a practice of offering money. Bonus money.
Now this would be about what,
1929 and 30.
Okay, in your senior year in Amherst.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we let it ride, and Cleveland sent me a letter requesting a tryout, and the Philadelphia Athletics also was so happy they were playing in Philadelphia at the same time. So I went down and I worked out with Cleveland one day, and the next day I went over and worked out with the Athletics.
Mm.
So I've got to begin to get involved. So I think, I'm not sure, but maybe you can tell me, I had the first bonus played a college ball player. I'm not sure about that. It was $10,000, which was a lot of money to me.
Yeah, I don't know that it was the first bonus, but it might have been the biggest up till then.
Uh-huh.
Did you meet Connie Mack at that time?
No, I didn't meet him, it was interestingly enough. I was only there for one short afternoon.
Who conducted the trial or watched you then?
One of his coaches, I don't remember that name.
Uh-huh.
But he knew that he may have been watching, I don't know, but I didn't meet him.
Yeah.
Because he was a coach then, wasn't he? That's what I remember.
Well, he was the manager.
The manager, right? Yeah.
And with Cleveland, who was your contact
Evans,
person?
I think it was Evans.
Billy Evans?
Billy Evans, mm-hmm. Evans was, yeah. He was on the West Coast, and anyone didn't want to match the $10,000 that Pittsburgh offered me then at that time. They had already offered him $10,000.
Okay, Pittsburgh made you the offer, and you didn't have to go to any trial with them.
No, because while I was at Kiskeya, I used to work out for a couple of weeks with the Pittsburgh Pirates before going to camp or coming back from camp. So I got a taste of it before I even signed anything.
Was that the only bonus offer you had?
Well, the Athletics. Cleveland and Pittsburgh were the only two, yes.
I was wondering whether they had to go to 10,000 to top somebody, or that's just what they offered.
No, I didn't know of any other offers. Mm. That were the only two offers. But to me, it seemed like it was the only... only teams that were offering bonuses at that time, but I may be wrong.
What do you remember of Barney Dreyfus?
Very fine man, very astute man, and generous to a point. And of course, I thought that his interest in me was more than I deserved at the time. He almost took me on as a son, and that sort of an attitude. And then, of course, before that, he offered me a bonus without naming the amount if I wouldn't play football at Amherst. He wanted to get me out of football, and I couldn't promise him that. And so his interest was put on hold then until I was ready. And I played football then, of course, and that article I gave him, he made one look at that because it is, without my knowledge, it's an article written here in a local paper and gives practically everything I ever did in life. And it's an interesting article.
Where'd they get the information?
From a classmate of mine who was living here, and he was that type of person. He was athletic research minded. So he got all the data together and gave them to this local paper.
Did you have any trouble collecting the $10,000 bonus?
None whatever, no.
I can relate to that amount of money because about that time, it was Depression time. Well, of course, in 29 is when it started.
Yes.
But my dad rented a farm and all of us worked and we got half of what the farm produced.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, maybe there's a possibility that we can buy this farm. Mm-hmm. And so we asked the owner how much it was, and it was the best farm around,
mm-hmm.
and best producing, and everybody agreed that it was a wonderful farm.
Mm-hmm.
And the price was $10,000, and we decided that there's no way that in a lifetime we could ever get $10,000 together.
Yeah, well,
so I can relate to
that. Yeah.
I can relate to what $10,000 was.
Right. It was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that a Pittsburgh contract that you signed?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you recall what it called for as far as a monthly or seasonal salary?
No, I think that I was making about equivalent about $750 a month.
Mm-hmm.
I had that in mind. And the Wainer Buds were getting $14,000 a year then, which was not a lot of money, of course.
Did your mother have any opinion about your playing pro ball?
No, I think she was sort of prepared for it by my father.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
At that point, were you ready to go to medical school? You've made up your mind?
I'm in Illinois when my father died.
Yeah. So you knew when you signed that you were going to be going to medical school.
Yeah, and Dreyfus knew that too.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't tell him I was going when I was going to quit playing.
Yeah.
But, he was a very fine man.
And this is after graduation in 1930.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did you go?
I went. I went to them right after. I went to them right after. As soon as I graduated, I went to the Paris immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And played there. In fact, I took over. The shortstop and not awful. A little peppery shortstop. I'd like to know that name.
We'll get it for you.
Yeah.
That's
I lugged the book around. You didn't go down to the minor leagues that year then?
No, I went
You stayed with the Pirates?
Yeah, in August I took over his shortstop and played the rest of the season. Oh my gosh. I'll think of it.
Oh, well, in 1930, Dick Bartel was a regular shortstop.
Dick Bartel, yeah.
Yeah.
Then he went to Philadelphia, I think.
After the season. But wait a minute. According to the record books, you got into only two games in 1930.
Well, maybe I didn't win. Was it only two games?
You were one for three.
Several weeks.
And you had one RBI and made one error in the two games.
Uh-huh.
Bartel was the regular shortstop then.
Was that the next year?
Maybe that was
and he was traded after 30.
Yeah, maybe it was the following year that I got this. But anyway, I remember...
Do you recall your first game?
I remember breaking in Philadelphia. I remember breaking in, and then we went up to Boston, and the thing that I remember most about Boston was that I stole home that game, and I think it was the deciding run. Earl Shealy was playing first base, and Robert Maranville was shortstop, and he had a habit of just throwing easily, on an easy ground ball play, not hurrying at all. He was a great shortstop. So knowing that, I took a lead off third base, and as soon as he threw to first base, I went home. And Earl Shealy was big and lumbering, and he was slow, so I beat him to throw home. And that started me, really, I think, that play itself, I think, helped me get started.
Mm.
You did that on your own and not from the guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first game?
I'm trying to think now. It was either Philadelphia. I think it was Philadelphia because I remember Paul Wainer at the time. He had been drinking. And he's known for his alcoholism.
Yeah.
And he said to me, what's it say out there at the scoreboard? How many ounces, you know? And he had four for four that day when he couldn't reach the scoreboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That could be any day in the life of Paul Wainer.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did it feel like to be... You were not in spring training, and to join the club like that, with the Wainers, with Bartel, with Pie Trainer, and guys like that, and here you come. What kind of a reception did you get?
Oh, a great reception. There was a great fellowship on that ball club at that time, and they were very encouraging, of course. And Bartel wasn't. I shouldn't put this in print, I guess. He didn't appear to be that well liked at the time. George Grantham was playing second base, and Gus Sewer was playing first base. They moved Grantham over to second base to make room for me to play shortstop. And then later on, Grantham went to first base. No, that was before, sir. Grantham went to first base, and I went to second base. And this all evolved while I was there. But I can't remember who played first base before Gus Sewer.
1930, when you got there.
Who was playing first?
Gus Sewer was there.
Was he playing first? He must have been.
Yeah. They also had Freddie Brickle, Clyde Engel.
Yeah.
And Grantham Bartel, Adam Komorowski was in the outfield with the Wainers, and
Eye Trainer third,
yeah.
Great guy, great wonderful guy.
And Raleigh Helmsley was catching.
Yeah, it was Raleigh. Was
Desi Vance was on the team.
Not in Pittsburgh, no.
I hit against David Vance. I remember him as well as I remember anybody.
Oh, yeah, okay.
A big guy with a long sleeve where he tried to distract people with this long, waving sleeve. And as I remember, I had three hits out of him playing against him. They were all singles.
Mm.
But I was meeting him. Oh, and another knuckleball player. What was his name? George... for the Cubs, wasn't he? He's a knuckleball. Grimes, wasn't he?
Well, Pearly Grimes is a spitball pitcher.
A spitball pitcher,
yeah.
Pearly Grimes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him. I got about 3 hits from him, and they took him out of the game because this rookie can hit them for 3 hits. And
I'm sure that didn't improve his disposition.
I was going off past first base, and he yelled at me, you old son of a bitch. half-assed push player. He was so mad. I'll never forget that. And of course, I had to take things like that too.
Yeah.
He was really mad.
Dizzy Dean would do the same thing.
Yeah, I remember Dizzy Dean. I remember him in St. Louis when we played them at the end of the season. They put him in the pitch. And he ran to third base on a bunt instead of first base. I mean, it was an awful game because they were already in first place in Chicago, and I think we were in Chicago. We were playing for second place, and so that blew up in the paper because they thought that the St. Louis Cardinals blew the game, and even thought that it was purposely blown. But I don't think that ever came out, as I remember. Little thing like that. Went out and I couldn't see. On a double play, I could get my glove up. I had to drop it on the ground. So they put me in right field then because I couldn't do anything. And I remember I caught a ball out there and threw it off the fence. And that's the end of the season.
What was your impression of Jewel Enns as the manager?
Jewel Enns was a very fair manager. I don't think that he was considered the most acute manager of the time, but very fair. And the manager I disliked, and I don't know whether I should say that or not, was Jordan Gibson. He was an ignoramus as far as I was concerned. He's a Canadian. He said that when he was a Canadian. I don't know that.
No, I didn't.
George Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody liked him. He was very disliked. In fact, toward the end of the season, we didn't want to look at his signs. Nobody paid any attention to it. It was that bad. And so they took me out of second base and put Trotsky or something like that.
I was in 32.
32.
Yeah. Tony Piatt.
Tony Piatt. He went later. I heard that he did very well for an automobile dealership in Chicago. Anyway, They didn't, the team wanted me in there. And so that stirred up a little bit of problem, mm-hmm. because they felt that I was more consistent hitter and I covered more ground, even at second base, than he did. And but Gibson was, he brought him up, and he was Gibson's favorite.
Yeah.
It was playing politics, and so the team used to, that started the feud between Gibson and the players.
Mm-hmm.
Just one little incident like that. So I felt very important, but I didn't care too much.
In 1930, when you joined the team, did any players voice any resentment that you're getting a bonus of him that amounted in many cases to more than they were making for a year?
I don't think they knew about it.
There was nothing in the paper? Nothing?
I don't think it was mentioned in the paper either. Because I didn't say anything about it. And Ronnie Travis was so tight-lipped, I don't think it got down, really.
Did he ask you to say nothing about it?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he said, well, now this is between you and me. And I didn't say anything. I didn't tell the people I got a bonus offer from Cleveland. They knew that I'd worked out with Philadelphia and
Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think the bonus was known about.
And none of the newspaper people asked you about it?
No.
Maybe it was so unusual that nobody even thought that you would get such a thing.
And probably
that
so.
That could be.
Chili Doyle, who I think is one of the finest of baseball writers,
mm-hmm.
He became a little busy at one time. I remember now, and I haven't thought about it. And he said, I remember something about it. You did very well, or something like that. But I didn't mention any figures.
He might have found out, but
yeah.
Didn't say anything also.
Possibly.
Yeah. What do you recall, what comes to mind when you hear some of these names, what springs to mind? High trainer. What do you think?
Very fine person. And probably the most inspiration I had in breaking in was high trainer. I don't think there's ever a better third baseman in baseball. He was so accurate, you know, he could take a ground ball off third base over the bag and almost lying down, throw the foot man off the foot, first base.
Mm.
He had a tremendous arm, and many times he made the second base look easy because that ball was right over the He was, and a fierce sort of manager, I think, a person I've ever met. He was a great, great cook.
Mm-hmm.
And we were excellent friends. Of course, he did go out of his way to help me to get oriented too. So I can't say too much about that.
And the Wainers, Paul and Lloyd.
Yeah. Well, they were sort of matter-of-fact people. They didn't take any real interest in anything that I thought of. And not overly intelligent, but taking each day as it came.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of an attitude.
Was there anybody who comported himself like a star?
No, I'm trying to think of, they all sort of took it as a matter of fact. They didn't think about a star. Unless it was a pitcher that I appreciated a lot, too, a left-hand pitcher.
Larry French?
Larry French, he was a good friend, and he was also a college player.
Mm-hmm.
We only had, I think, a couple of college graduates on our team.
That was more than many teams had in that time.
Right.
And Heinie Meinie.
Well, he was sort of a guy that he took it for granted he was up there and pitching, and he was not an overpowering pitcher. He was, an intelligent pitcher in the sense that he knew how to mix mix his pitches out. He didn't have a hard fastball, but he had what we call a change of pace ball, and a slow curve and a fast curve, and he got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't exceptional at all.
Larry French would not hesitate to throw at hitters.
No, he was aggressive. He was he was the only aggressive man we had in the pitching staff. Really aggressive. And he kept that team together emotionally. And I think his attitude was all for the ball club. And he meant it. But he still had a lot of humor. He was the most humorous of the group. And they were all crazy that way.
A lot of practical jokers?
Yeah, oh my, we wouldn't believe it.
Hmm. And Ray Kramer?
Ray Kramer was a very steady, not spectacular, and almost nonchalant type of pitcher.
Hmm. Was he a heavy drinker?
He didn't drink much, he had seven, no. He was a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
And a lot of loose morals on trips and so forth that I couldn't take. I mean, that did bother me.
Who was your roommate?
Tom Femenow.
Uh-huh.
Tom Femenow.
What was he like as a person?
Rather intimate in a sense. And yet, another sense, he would keep you at bay. I can mention some things that shouldn't be in print, but... on some of these trips, and it was my awakening of the loose morals of this group. There wasn't a Christian on that team, let's put it that way.
Did that surprise you?
Or came near Christian. No, I was expecting it because I heard these stories, and after being with them for a few months, I could see why and how they came out.
In those...
immoralities or something.
In those years, was there a curfew? I mean, did the manager try to rein anybody in?
Yes, they did. They sometimes would be somebody sitting in the lobby watching and so forth. And of course, they would come in much later than anticipated, in midnight sometimes, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And not too sober either, and pitch the next day.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. That was a fascinating thing. That they could shake it off in the morning and go out and pitch in the afternoon. Yeah.
Were there fines? I mean,
there were fines. In fact, I was fined once, and that was what was another thing that was disturbing. I was in hitting practice one day, and Larry French came over and said, "Hey, what is this about your $100 fine?" I said, "I don't know anything about $100 fine." "Well, it's pretty well known that you've been fined $100. What happened?" And I had no idea, so I went up to Bossy Marnie Raptors. I said, "I understand I've been fined $100. He said, "Yes." I said, he said, "I'm sorry to do this, but there was so much pressure on me." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, your manager came up to see me. He said that he fined me because you were studying too much." And I said, "Well, I don't understand, studying too much." Well, he said, "The word got out that you were going up to the University of Pittsburgh, and that you were studying every night till 10 o'clock. And I was going up there doing a section that I wanted, medicine I wanted to eventually go into that gynecology, which I did. And so I wanted to go up, and I'd done a male dissection at Yale. And I wanted to get a female dissection. So I was up there in the morning till 10 o'clock some mornings, but maybe a couple of hours doing dissection. I think he heard about that. So he fined me $100 because he didn't think my interest was in the ball club. Well, I guess I was one of the few that went to bed every night at 10 o'clock to behave myself.
Yeah, so, you're talking about in the morning.
Yeah. In the morning.
You weren't missing any practice, though.
No, I didn't miss anything. But he didn't, and I would carry maybe a medical book with me on trips or something like that. And
well, that may be a first. Everybody else is out getting drunk and everything all night.
Yeah, right.
You're getting fined for studying in the morning.
Yeah, I know. I don't think that was ever. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
And the manager didn't come to you and say anything.
No, I was thinking.
Everybody knew it before you did.
Yeah, he was, we were walking along the street, he'd go on the other side of the street, wouldn't talk to me. That's right.
What manager was this?
Yeah, is this Gibson?
George Gibson.
Yeah. Well, this is not Ann.
No, this is George Gibson.
32.
He was ignoramus, really.
I want to back up a minute here. You're with the Pirates throughout 30 seasons.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You only get into two games, but you're there and you're on the bench with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then what? At some point you enrolled where?
Yale University.
You enrolled in Yale to start in the fall of 30.
Yes,
You have to leave the team early?
Yeah, well, what happened was, and I don't know how they ever put up with it, I didn't join them until May, usually around the May 5th, 6th, 10th, around there. I would work out with the Yale team and to get my school year in, and they accepted that, and I only went to spring training 1 year, and that was with Gibson out of Paso Robles.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing, so I was very fortunate to be able to play for the Pirates without going to spring training.
And then you'd have to leave early in the fall?
No, I was able to finish the fall, and then I would make up the studies then, during the year.
Okay, so you're going to Yale, and you're going into pre-med?
Right. Mm-hmm.
At Yale.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay, so then in 31 you joined the team late.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, and then in the fall of 31 you're going into your second year in Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other people on that team, Herb Brain.
Herb Brain, yeah. Brain comes back. He was a steady pitcher, one of the Kramer type, and they were dependable pitchers. We went 43 innings without a run one time. 43 games, I think, or something. I forgot the record. We set a record or something without pitching.
Oh, yeah, somewhere there. I think they pitched five straight shutouts, something like
that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I remember that now. I forgot all about that.
And what was Adam Komorowski like?
Oh, he was an easygoing fellow and took everything as a kind, not particularly ambitious and not overpowering either as a hitter and a fairly reliable outfielder, played right field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, rather left field. And Woody Johnson came on after he did, I think, I remember. Anyway, I could tell a couple instances off the record that were interesting about Komorowski. If you can turn it off, you don't want to go on
the record. On the record.
Yeah.
And Gus Shore.
Gus Shore was another type who was not educated greatly. I don't know if I recall, but I don't think he had a college exposure at all. And he took a lot of kidding, of course. And he was very reliable, one of the spectacular first basemen. And he was businesslike about it. He was serious about his work. And some of them weren't, but they just took as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of anything unusual about Gus Shore.
What was Honus Wagner still a coach with the team then?
No, No, we had Jewel Lands and Donnie Bush. They were the people that I worked with.
Mm-hmm. And George Grantham.
George Grantham was also serious about his work very encouraging, I think, and unusually so with me, because he anticipated, I think, my moving over to second base, at that time. But he never seemed resentful or anything. He was very much a gentleman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did anybody teach you anything?
I know they gave me these workouts that they give you were difficult workouts. They had a fungus and the ball, a fungus bat and the ball, and they chased you either side, putting spin on the ball and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget those workouts. They were coming from college, and all I knew to do was to keep my eye on the ball, whether it was spinning or away or toward me or a bad hop and so forth. Then they would work on you on the short hops and that sort of thing, see whether you can handle the short hop or how you play the hop and all.
Mm-hmm.
It was really scientific. I don't think they realized how scientific it was.
It's kind of routine.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a morning practice or before game?
Usually before games, before the even the workout before games,
It was more
They
had more extensive infield practice then, didn't they?
Yes, we had a real workout infield practice.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And I enjoyed it too. I enjoyed it, I think, as much as I maybe more so than playing many times. Because it was a good fellowship, except for I probably disagreed with the morals in some ways. I didn't show it though, my disagreement. I just looked like I.
It would have been bad news for you if you had.
I had to be one of the boys.
Yeah.
What did you do on the train rides generally?
Usually studying.
And did you get kidded for that?
Oh yes. Another incident about Komorowski is. I went out the dining car and left my book on neurology, typical book on neurology, and I came back and I found Komorowski with the book open. He had it upside down. He said, "What do you get out of all this anyhow?" He said, "What is this?" I said, "It's too much for me to explain to you, Adam." So, we used to tease him about it. He came from Sawyerville, and nobody ever said that. I always call him Sawyerville. and he was sensitive about some things.
This was a forerunner to Bobby Brown and Yogi Berra, wasn't it?
Bobby Brown was playing then.
And too. Yogi Berra was
the same way.
Yogi read.
Yeah.
We asked Bobby Brown one time, and he said that was the story is true that Yogi was looking at his medical book, and Yogi wanted
to. Fine gentleman, but I wasn't. John Brown.
Fine man.
And he went on and worked with the Zuntar chip as he went along.
Finally
got his medical degree.
You got into 53 games in 31. Did you expect to play every day, or how was that?
Well, I expected to play every day, and I thought most of the time that I did. When they made the shift, a second baseman and seven out shortstop.
Maybe after they made the shift, you played every day, but you got into 53 games.
I got in too because of my pinch hitting. I was pinch hitting about 600 or something like that, and so they used me a lot as a pinch hitter.
What's the psychology of pinch hitting? Sitting on the bench in the late innings and maybe in a crucial spot, you got to go up and hit for the first time. Is it more difficult?
No, I think it's more inspiring, and it gives you a little confidence that they expect me to get out there and hit. I must be all right, that sort of a feeling.
Yeah.
So you go up there very confident as a rule.
It's not because it's just your turn at bat, it's because they're asking you to go up there.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it didn't bother me, and you'd think it might because I never placed college pitching like we had it going over the major leagues right away. But I had a good eye, I was not a heavy hitter. I was more singles, doubles, a few triples.
Mm-hmm.
But, I wasn't what they call. Of course, we didn't have the fastball. I mean, the lively ball then that we have today, neither.
Yeah. Well, that was a hitting time though. Yeah. Batting averages were high.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There were a lot of good hitters around.
Right.
And then along came Archie Vaughn. What do you remember about Archie Vaughn?
Markey came along and a good infielder, and he had good range too. He learned to switch hit even at a late time. Well, I suppose maybe just briefly to coming into the play shortstop. So Markey had a lot of ability. He had a lot of ability. He's a good shortstop, and. He hit for extra bases, but he's not a home run hitter, but he hit for extra bases a lot, too.
He was fast.
Yeah. Yeah. 1932 was his rookie year,
uh-huh.
And he was in 129 games
right.
At shortstop.
I was sad about his departure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Well, he was a hitter.
Yeah. Very, very self-confident, too. I don't remember where he played before he came with the Pirates. I don't remember that at all.
Well, that was his rookie year. That was his first year in the major leagues, 1932.
I mean, before he came to major leagues.
I don't know.
I never knew that.
Well, George Gibson, despite his shortcomings as a manager, did manage to finish second.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was the year.
To the Cubs.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember what you got as your piece of the World Series money? Finishing second?
I think it was a little over $1,000. I remember. I don't remember the exact amount.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we were anticipating that money.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was around $1,200 that I got. Close to $1,200. Of course, that seemed like a lot of money, too. Of course, I wasn't making that much money either.
Yeah. Then you went back to school, and then what?
What
was your last year with the Pirates?
Yeah. And I left early that last year with them. The reason for that was that, one of the reasons was that Pyatt coming in there and Wichita needed an infielder, so they sent me out there to fill in for about 3 weeks. And a fellow named Gibbs, who was manager then, I went out there and played, I think, 3 weeks in the league out there, just filling in. And then I came back, and Gibson was still there, as I recall. And I got a terrible reception when I came back. He didn't want me around. He didn't even invite me. Oh, I know what happened then. Max Carey was managing the Brooklyn Dodgers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard that, I had trouble getting in the lineup in Yale that year. And he heard about, oh yes. And I came down to meet with the club in New York. And I wasn't even invited to work out. You know, with him. I thought, well, something's going on there. And I think Gibson may have his mind that he wasn't going to use me. So Matt Carey heard about it, and he called me. He knew the hotel I was staying. He said, why don't you come on and work out with it over here? We need an infielder. So I went over and put on a Brooklyn outfit.
Now, when was this? 32.
My last year.
Your last year. Okay.
And so he was pleased, so he offered them $35,000. I mean, Pittsburgh won $35,000 for him. Now, this may not be in the record, I don't know. And so Max wouldn't come up with the 35. And so I was left in space there for not knowing what to do, because I wasn't invited to join the team then in Philadelphia. And so this started a series of events that made me get a little bit sour on the whole thing, because I felt maybe I was selfish, but at the same time I was looking out for my own interests too and my own ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me to, this was getting late now in the season, we were getting into late August or something and sent me to Williamsport, needed an infielder. So they sent me over there. And then from there, then later on at Wichita, I guess it was that sequence. So Wichita, the minor leagues were in very poor shape actually at that time. They were all in very good shape.
Yeah, a lot of them were folding up, that's right.
Yeah, right. And so the manager out there, I wish I could remember his name. He called us into, he called me in and said, we're having trouble paying salaries. He said, I think you know that. Could you break your contract so that we wouldn't have to pay you what we're... this is awful to say this, to think about this. I said, no. I said, I'm not breaking any contract. I'm under contract. And I said, baseball isn't that important to me right now. So he said, okay. So then I decided I'm going to go back to Pittsburgh. So I got my things together, got on the train to go back to Pittsburgh and see what goes on. And I hadn't thought about this for a long time. And so here I went back to the lounge car, and here was the manager going back at the same time, didn't tell me. So here was a team left without an infielder and without a manager. So we got back, and I went to the Barney Drives' office, and I told my story to him, and he said, you're still under contract. I said, I understand I am. They said, we can't do anything about that. He said, as far as what's his name concerned, we'll have to give him some money to finish out. So so then they sent me to Williamsport. And I thought, well, here I am playing minor league ball when I said I never would play. They broke the contract. They said, my contract said no, I would not be sent to the minors.
You got a Pittsburgh contract for 32.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is strange. It doesn't seem like Barney Dreyfus. And I think there was a lot of pressure coming in there from Ben Swanger, who was his son-in-law. And so then they called us in, wanted to know whether we would, they couldn't pay us. This is Williamsport.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't pay us the salary. So I went back to Pittsburgh again. And I said, I'm the only one that's receiving a salary here. And I said, it looks bad to me. And I said, I don't know what my future is now. So they said, you better go back and finish out with Williamsport, just like that. So instead of that, I had an externship offered to me. So I just left. I left the club at the Williamsport. They wanted to fine me for that. They wanted to outline me from baseball because I skipped the contract.
Mm-hmm.
And who was the general manager of the league, the National League? And, you have to help me out on that.
President of the National League?
Yeah. I thought I'd never forget.
At that time was not Frick. It was
before Frick.
No.
What's his name? I know it so well. Landis?
Landis was the commissioner, not
commissioner,
the president of the National League.
Commissioner Landis.
Okay.
Commissioner Landis, okay.
So I went to the commissioner. I said, I've been told I'm being outlawed from the league. And I said, I don't mind being outlawed, but I don't like the way it's handled. And so it was already facing that, I'm being an outlaw. I said, well, I'd like to have some assurance that this is being rescinded because I don't deserve this. And I told him all the circumstances. So he reinstated me. So I still belong to the Pirates.
Did you get paid? Well, I don't know. Did you get paid through the 32 season?
Without any.
You were suspended.
Yeah, without any remuneration, whatever.
Yeah.
So I didn't care then. I thought, this is the way this is going to be. This is the time for me to sort of concentrate on this. So I just left and went back and took an externship at Yale. That was in September. Yeah.
Okay, so your opinion of Dreyfus changed?
It's changed, but then I thought that he is under pressure. And because we heard a lot about this fellow Ben Swanger, I think I got that name right.
Mm-hmm.
that he was pressuring. Of course, he finally, I think he pushed to drive us out of his ownership.
Dreyfus, well, I don't know. Dreyfus owned the team, but...
Yeah, I mean, out of his interest or anything. He was getting a little bit...
Somewhere along the line, did you confront Dreyfus with the fact that your contract said that you could not be sent out?
Contract could not be what?
That you could not be sent to the minors under your contract?
Yes, I did. But then they broke the... They were the ones that broke the contract. I mean, they said,
what was
well,
his defense
it, has
of
to, it has to be this way because we're still paying your salary. So he completely ignored the fact about the miners. I mean, he just went way to the side.
You got your major league salary.
Yeah, I got my salary.
Until you got suspended.
Yeah. Until I got suspended.
Yes, yeah.
Then okay. I got nothing.
And somewhere along the line, after that, you remained Pittsburgh property, in a sense.
Right.
Did you ever get your outright release?
Never got an outright release, no. I just never went back. I just dropped it altogether.
Did they send you a contract for 33?
No, I had nothing but my original contract.
Sent you one every year.
That was still in effect until I was thrown out. The league altogether.
Then they
so
never
that terminated my contract at the same time. I assumed anyhow.
So to this day, you're still on the suspended list of Pittsburgh Pirates?
I guess that's true. I never followed up.
That's probably a record.
I'm still property. I'm still property of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Believe it or not.
Well, you could probably get your free agency now if you wanted to sign with somebody else, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I could have been.
Anywhere along the line in your baseball career, did you ever do any barnstorming during the off season or anything like that?
Not off the season, no.
You
just,
never played
just during
against
the season.
Was that?
Just during the season we would barnstorm sometimes. During the season.
Did you ever play against black, Negro ball?
Yes, I did. I played against the Homestead Grays once when I was in prep school. I was 17 years old, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Out in Dormont, Pennsylvania. We were playing the winners of the church league there. So they asked me if I would come in and play shortstop. And here I was in prep school.
Uh-huh.
So I played shortstop against Satchel Paige and the Homestead Grays.
That's
another
thing
in my life.
Josh Gibson catching then?
Pardon?
Was Josh Gibson there?
Yes, Josh Gibson. I remember that day as long as I live. I was scared to death. They hit every ball out of the ballpark. I mean, it was amazing. And I never saw a pitching like that day in my life. I didn't know what was going on, frankly. I just watched the ball come in, being sure I couldn't get hit.
Yeah. My friend Jim Riley, who was supposed to be with us today, but he's sick.
Yeah.
This is his particular interest.
Oh.
And he and a few other fellows are restoring or compiling the records of the old Negro League.
Uh-huh.
And they've done a real good job. But, you know, lots of times they would play ball, but there wasn't even a reporter there, and there was no box score kept. So they have done a great job, and that's his interest. And so these questions are sort of in his behalf, and he knows probably more about Negro ball players than anybody else. And I say Negro because that's what they were called then. I'm talking in the time then.
Right.
So if you could recall any of the players on that team and what their abilities or weaknesses or anything that you happen to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the only contact I had.
I guess if Josh...
That one game, right?
Yeah, only that one game.
If Josh Gibson hit a line drive at you, I guess you'd remember it.
But did Satchel... Did Satchel...
I could see them as a good major league ball club, and even as a kid, practically.
Mm-hmm.
I thought these guys could beat the Pirates, or they could work, play against the Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did Satchel pitch that game?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You recall the names of any of the others, or?
No, I don't remember Gibson and
Gibson and Page.
That's all I remember. Any other players.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I was such a brief moment in my life that.
Yeah.
Did they sort of clown around and toy with you?
Oh yes, they were a bunch of clowns. Yeah. Yeah.
They get a comfortable lead and then have fun.
I remember one fellow coaching third base waving to me to come in. Here, the hard-hitting ball team. No reason to come in. I don't think he was trying to kid me a little bit. Come on in. Well, come on in. Come in closer. If I'd done that, I got killed.
Yeah.
I remember that too. That's amazing. I haven't thought of that since it's done.
Well, this is a lot of people are getting opinions now of those who saw it and feel that perhaps some of those teams could very well have played in the major leagues.
Oh yes, definitely. I'm sure of that. Yeah.
I believe it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what a career he had, Cecil Page.
Now let me find out now. Now that you're out and you're in med school, you graduate and so forth. And what was your specialty? And tell us something about your life as a doctor.
The first thing I want to find out about the life as a doctor was you used the term externship, which I hadn't heard before.
Uh-huh.
What does that mean?
That meant that you went in as a student and did internship duties as before graduation.
You did internship duties, but not as an intern.
And not for the title intern.
Yeah.
We did the same things with under supervision, of course, too.
But you were an undergraduate.
Yeah, undergrad.
Uh-huh. At Yale.
Now they graduate and they go to a hospital and do internship.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the residency.
Yeah.
After that.
But you're still a student. If you're a student doing internship, you're an extern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Then I, of course, I really got involved in medicine then and took it seriously. And when I got my special training, I taught in five different medical schools, from USC to New York Hospital.
Did you ever teach at Emory?
No, I never got to Emory. It's a fine school.
I have a son.
I just got my notice a couple months ago. I'm an emeritus assistant associate professor now of gynecology at University of Miami. So that's my final reward.
What were the other schools?
I went, of course, from Yale, I went down to a fellowship in New York, which brought back some memories, Presbyterian New York, and then substituted the New York Hospital again, then the University of Pennsylvania, and I took 2 years of surgery there. And then I decided, instead of general surgery, I'd go into gynecology. I went back to Pittsburgh. My mother was still there, and did a residency there in obstetrics and gynecology. And then from there, I was doing a lot of research at the University of Pittsburgh, not cutting off appendages. I did a lot of research.
You'd already learned how to do that.
And in endocrinology, as in respect to obstetrics and gynecology. And we did some very fine work there. Even built up a colony of mice and did everything that works. So I was invited out to USC to work with them out there because we had written some papers. And then I went into Navy. Of course, I ended up after that with the Mayo Foundation, which we now have up here in Jacksonville also, in Rochester. And the University of Minnesota instructing and then doing some practice up there, and I was in the Mayo Foundation at the University of Minnesota. And then I was invited down here to help get this medical school oriented, but it wasn't built yet, it was about a year and a half ahead, and I organized the first training program in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Miami, and that's how I got to be emeritus later on. So I've had quite a career in medicine rather than baseball.
You were never in private practice then?
Not completely, no. I was always teaching I enjoyed doing some teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Was the $10,000 bonus instrumental in your going to Yale, or would you have gone anyhow?
Oh, I would have gone anyhow, because I was concerned about still, my ambition was to get into medicine even then, but I thought that, well, I enjoyed playing baseball.
But you didn't need the baseball money to go.
No. I've been on a scholarship at Yale. $600. It was $600 tuition. Now it's $22,000.
Yeah, small difference.
$600 tuition, and they insisted on my taking it. They knew darn well. I told them I didn't need it. So the $10,000 I paid off a mortgage of my mother's house. She was living with my grandmother and renting it, and so that she could rent it. So I took $3,700 of that and paid off a mortgage. So I had that much left to the medical school.
You were in Yale when Larry Kelly was there.
Yeah,
playing football.
Yeah.
And George
Bush. I was on the backfield coaching staff at Yale.
You were there in the when they beat Princeton 7-0 then.
Yeah.
The upset of the century.
Right.
You were you at that game?
Yeah,
one of the managers was George Bush's uncle.
Oh yes,
Walker.
Walker, yes. Mm-hmm.
Louis Walker.
Yeah.
I did a story about that. I went to see each member of that 34 team.
Is that right?
I think two of them were no longer living. The Iron Men.
Yeah.
The 11 guys that played the whole game.
Was the backfield All-American? Remember he played in the backfield?
Yeah.
He became a referee and he's been refereeing football for years. Donnie Bush, but you probably know who it is. Well, when you think of it.
The backfield man. Jerry Roscoe was the quarterback.
Yes, Booth, was his name Booth?
Oh, Albie Booth?
Albie Booth, yeah.
He was not on that team.
No, he wasn't on that same team.
No.
That was before Kelly.
Yeah, he was early.
And
Kelly won the Heisman Trophy that year.
Right, I think he was an end, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's the guy that caught the pass.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And I coached the freshman basketball team at Yale, too, so I had a little interest there at the same time. So I played for three sports in college, majored in three sports.
Mm-hmm. He was also a first baseman.
Yeah, right.
Kelly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, that was an interesting football year there.
Yeah.
What do you remember about being in the National League, playing against the Cardinals of those days and the Cubs and John McGraw and the Giants? Was there a lot of bench jockeying, a lot of fighting?
You mean between each other?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot of insults going back and forth at times and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gas House Gang, they were all...
Yeah?
They were the most aggressive bunch of guys.
Who were the big mouths on the Pirates?
Larry French. He was the aggressor and the big mouth, yeah. He really gave it right. And Sweeney, his name, the pitcher. He was university. He was the other university, Pittsburgh.
Sweeney?
Sweeney.
There was a guy named Spencer.
Is that Glenn Spencer?
Right.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a Pittsburgher.
Bob Swift?
No, Bob, I remember Bob Swift.
Oh, okay. Swetonic.
Yeah, Swetonic. Yeah.
Steve Swetonic.
Steve Swetonic.
Yeah.
The two of them were the upstarts of the whole team.
And Earl Grace was a catcher.
Yeah, good catcher, good arm. He used to pull a trick when he's catching in practice. While he'd throw the second base, I'd put my back to him and catch the ball coming from Earl Grace. He was that accurate. I could depend on. I didn't. Took a chance, got hit in the face or something, but we were able to pull that stunt once in a while, too. I remember that about Earl Grace.
You could catch him between your legs, backwards.
We did some crazy things.
Did you get much riding from McGraw, do you remember?
Well, sort of quiet. I mean, you could hear him, and you could feel it was on. It was something that we didn't like to hear, but he wasn't
that was right at the very end.
He wasn't coaching anymore.
He was a sick man, pretty much.
He didn't have long to live.
Yeah.
Right, that's right. He was great manager, though.
But even
they had a great team. Last time I hit them was against Carl Hubbell. I had a bad knee, and
you don't have to be embarrassed about being struck out by Carl Hubbell.
No.
That screwball was just impossible. If you faced him frequently, maybe you could do something with it, but when you just occasionally faced that screwball, it was rough.
Yeah. The Cubs had a mean pitching staff at that time, too.
Is Burley Grimes on that?
Grimes, yeah. and Warnke. And
Lon Warnke, yeah.
Guy Bush, and Pat Malone, and Charlie Ruth. Those guys would just as soon brush you back as look at you.
They were, and they were mean. Yes, they really were. And that doesn't bother me for some reason.
It was an accepted part of the game.
Yeah.
You didn't go out to the
well, except in the body a couple of times, but I never got seriously endangered, but that was accepted.
And Dean would throw at you as soon as look at you.
Oh, yeah. He was a crazy guy.
Did you ever get involved in any brawls on the field?
No, I stayed quiet and about my business. I didn't get involved with anybody. I rarely even swore at anybody.
Did you ever get thrown out of a game?
No, never did. I objected, but I was never that vigorous about it. I had another experience, but that's not interesting, really. I have to put on paper anyway. They chewed a tobacco a lot. There was a lot of tobacco chewing going on. There was a messy place on it. Spitting all over the place and everything. So we were playing... So I just thought I'd take a chew of beechnut tobacco. I'll never forget that, beechnut tobacco. And I was on third base, chewing away, and I decided to steal home. Well, I stole home, and I made it, but I swallowed the tobacco. And I got so sick, I got to the bench, and I started vomiting, and they had taken me out of the game. And that was the last time I chewed beechnut.
Had somebody tried to...
They
were
all talking.
Oh,
sure, they were all
talking.
Well, why don't be one of us?
Come
on, hey, take a good chew, you know.
So you tried it.
I imagine
every ball player in that day tried it.
Oh, yeah. It was very customary to be chewing tobacco.
Did they try to make a drinker out of you?
Yeah, the only time I took a drink was I sat with that game at St. Louis, and that was a disaster, too.
That must have been in 31, I guess.
Yeah.
And the Cardinals had already clinched the pennant.
Right, that was 31.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be one of the boys, you know. I'll never forget that alcohol going around the locker room. I don't know how anybody played that day. In fact, the manager of the Cardinals didn't even come out for the game.